So today I'm going to talk about Günther Prien. It may start out somewhat depressing, and that is because Prien was growing up in depressing times. I had some difficulties reading his memoirs because the font used is the calligraphic Fraktur, which was the standard at the time. Yet I enjoyed reading it a lot. It really gave me some insight into where Prien was coming from, not just geographically, of course, but also what he experienced as a young man. So, Günther Prien, he was born on the 16th of January 1908 in Osterfeld, which was back then in the province of Saxony, and today in occupied Germany, in the federal state of Saxony-Anhalt. His father was a judge, and he had two younger siblings, Liselotte and Hans Joachim. To give you a first impression of what life was like in the Weimar Republic, I will quote Prien from his memoirs. Quote, "It was in Leipzig, in the grievous summer of 1923. Inflation had plundered us all. Our parents had become poor. The streets we walked looked grey, filthy, and squalid." End quote. Prien then goes on to describe how he and his friend were debating how to best break the news to their parents that they intended to become sailors. For reasons unknown to me, Prien's father did not live with them in Leipzig, so in Prien's case, it was his mother he had to convince. From early age on, Günther had wanted to become a sailor. Over his bed, he had a picture of Vasco da Gama hanging, the famous Portuguese explorer who was the first to find a naval route to India and thus gave Portugal a monopoly for the trade with India for a few decades. And that one was the favorite of all his seagoing heroes of the past, as Prien himself puts it. Again and again, he read these stories about da Gama's life and how he came back from India a hero, honored by the king and celebrated by his people. A life like that is what he dreamed about in his childhood, and in some ways that dream became true for his own life, as we shall see. So he went home and, quoting again, "The table had already been set. Liselotte and Hans Joachim were sitting in their high children chairs, pale and intimidated. On the vertigo were three letters in blue envelopes, bills. My mother entered and brought in the food. We had barley soup. We ate in silence. Is it a lot? I asked and tilted my head towards the blue envelopes. The worst is the dentist, she sighed and added. People who have nothing to bite don't really need teeth, do they? I looked at her. In her kind, round face, there was a tormented, bitter trait. No, I couldn't tell her. At least not today." End quote. Eventually, he gathered enough courage and did tell her. She was not exactly pleased, but she knew that it had been his dream for so long, and so she gave her approval. She had no money with which she could have paid for his education to join the German merchant navy, but Günther had earned, as a tourist guide, 91 Swedish kronor, or crowns, which were just enough to pay for the three-month class at the German school for seamanship at Finkenwerder in Hamburg. Please keep in mind that the German mark was as good as worthless in these times, so having foreign currency was probably the only way to keep your money's worth, aside from having precious metals or similar valuables or commodities.
Yeah, that's pretty much the same today, isn't it? Sweden has a very high exchange rate, so it was obviously quite high back then. One of the things that just struck me then, Schmidt, as you were talking, was Leipzig. Wasn't that the same place that Hitler was brought up in? Am I wrong there, or am I right there? Dennis, can you answer that one? Where am I remembering Leipzig from?
If I may... maybe Dennis has some sound problems. I don't know where you make this connection with Leipzig, but Hitler spent a lot of his time, his early youth in Vienna, as far as I know, and he grew up in Braunau in Austria.
I wonder where I'm thinking of Leipzig from. Yeah, but Braunau, I mean, wasn't it, that Hitler was brought up in? But
yes.
I was just thinking Leipzig, I'm sure I remember it from somewhere. And barley soup. I mean, that shows you how poor they were, doesn't it? You know, they're not having vegetable soup, but barley soup. You know, they're using cereals to make soup from. I mean, that shows you that they're not very well off if they having to use something like that in order to make the soup. I mean, I wouldn't want to have barley soup, would you?
No, not really. Certainly wouldn't be what I would pick.
Considering
that his father was a judge, so I would say that his family wasn't the worst off. I think a lot of Germans were even much worse off than that.
Dennis, where am I thinking of Leipzig from?
Do you know, I haven't a clue. I really haven't.
but it wouldn't have been that that swastika that was on the church. Was that at Leipzig? Or was he educated at Leipzig at some point?
So. Does it ring a bell?
Well, perhaps it will come to me at some point, maybe not by the end of the podcast, but hopefully it will. I'm sure I remember it from somewhere. I'll try and have a think. Anyway, Schmidt, if you've suitably refreshed yourself, if you'd like to continue.
Yes. After those 3 months, Prien and his friend passed the exams. However, because of the dire economic situation, nobody wanted to hire them. The director of the school, through his connections, was able to find a ship, the full-rigged ship Hamburg, that would take them, but they would not get any money and instead would have to pay 30 marks, the reasoning being that they would be more of a hindrance to the ship than be helpful as they were still learning, which doesn't really make sense, but I guess times were really that bad. Neither Günther Prien nor his friend would have been able to pay that, and so the director talked to the responsibles again and was able to get that fee off the table. Prien's friend, however, still asked what pay they were going to get. In the end, they at least were promised that it would start at zero mark and then slowly rise, whatever that would mean in the end. The Hamburg, as I mentioned before, was a full-rigged ship, a sailing ship, and Prien was about to learn sailing and seamanship in the true sense of these words, and the hard way. He started at the very bottom of the ship's hierarchy, and his first job was to clean the toilets. The food was terrible. They would eat bread out of which bugs would crawl if you hit the hard bread on the table. The rest of the food wasn't that much better, except on Sundays sometimes when it was somewhat decent. They also had a terrible cook, but some more of that later. At times he would have to go aloft in the worst of weathers and adjust the sails with his fellow sailors. The main mast was 55 meters high, and there were 28 different sails to take care of. His hands would nearly freeze in the cold weather, and yet the work was so hard that his shirt would cling to his back from the sweat. Yet he also experienced moments which made it all worth to him. The following quote is right after he describes the hard work and the shirt clinging to his back. Quote, "But sometimes I did look around to watch the moonlight play on the white canvas. Even more beautiful, though, when I was standing on the deck again. There, three silvery towers were rising in front of me, their tops disappearing in the night sky. The wind was singing in them, and from below, the deep and regular rushing of the bow wave. We were sailing. It was as if an invisible power had taken hold of the ship and was dragging it along, softly but irresistibly. No engine noise, only this deep, regular rushing." End quote. They were sailing in the Bay of Biscay and then towards the Azores. Their destination was the Americas, and more specifically Pensacola. Some of the crew were plotting to leave the ship there because they were so fed up with the hard work, the bad food, and general conditions. Prien was almost convinced by some of them, as they painted a picture of how great life in the United States would be for them, and he was friends with one of the would-be defectors. But an older, wiser sailor by the name of Vitashek talked some sense back into Prien. He would be neglecting his duty, and worst of all, he could never again be a sailor. Nobody would hire a sailor who was known to have defected from a ship, he said. "Look, I know the food we were given was terrible. The captain was behaving like a tyrant, but an honest sailor just doesn't do that." And that made an impression on Preen. He told the others that he would not join them, but he also did not report any of this to the captain. One morning after they were anchored at Pensacola, 9 of the crew were missing, including the cook, or smutje, as the cook is called in German naval jargon. The captain and the boatswain were furious, but only one of the defectors was re-apprehended, as he was stupid enough to try to go back on board to fetch some things he had left behind. As they lifted the anchors to sail back home, they sang a shanty, a sailor song, which is sung only once each voyage, this particular shanty, precisely when they started their voyage back home. You may be surprised to hear that it's sung in English, but by the way, the dialects of Northern Germany are even closer to English than other German dialects, both languages having Germanic at their root, with English merely having some of the non-Germanic influences mixed in. The shanty goes as follows. "Rolling home, rolling home, rolling home across the sea, rolling home to my old Hamburg, rolling home, my land, to thee."
Do they actually sing that in English, or did they sing that in German and you've translated it to English? Do you mean they actually used to sing this song in English and others in English, Schmidt?
Yes, they did. I was actually quite surprised, but I thought it was because Northern Germany is somewhat more maybe akin to England, has an affinity towards England. Maybe it's that. And I think the sailors had a lot in common. They would meet each other, at least in times of peace, and exchange songs. I'm guessing that is why that is.
That really does surprise me. And the German language is quite different to English. I know the Anglo-Saxon language back then, it was probably similar, but then the English language changed when the Normans came over. They banned the Anglo-Saxon language. Nice to think of them singing in English songs in their white brothers' language. I think it's really good of him to refuse to give up like the others did. Now, that shows that he had character, and I believe that when you first go on a vessel, when you've never been at sea before, that they will deliberately treat you as hard as possible, you know, to sort of break you in, as it were, because then they know that you'll put up with whatever. If you get rough weather, then you're prepared for it. You've already seen life as hard as it can get. They want people that they can really rely on when you're at sea. You don't want someone that's going to freak out at sea because there's nowhere for them to go. They can't leave the boat once the boat has left the shore. It's not like you're on land and you can leave work and you can just walk out and throw your hands up in the air. You've got to stay there, and you've also got to have a stable temperament so that other people aren't put at risk. So I would suggest that the skipper of the vessel was deliberately being harsh with them in order to test them out, if that was his first voyage. That's from what I know of voyaging and going to sea anyway. Dennis, have you got any comments you'd like to make on that before Schmidt continues?
Well, interesting enough, I was in the Bay of Biscay once on a cruise, and everybody, including myself on board, was seasick. One of the most memorable times of my life. No, one of the biggest disappointments is that Messerschmitt didn't sing that song. I was working.
I don't think I have the voice for that, to be honest.
Did it have music with it? Was it possible to sing it? Or does it just have the line there?
No, I don't know the tune, but actually I think the tune is mentioned. I think he writes something this text goes to the tune of this and or that song, but I am not familiar with it. So even if I would have wanted to, I couldn't have.
Fair enough.
Do you sing at all, Schmidt? You've got a very bassy voice. So I imagine you'd probably be quite good in a choir with the bass.
Only under the shower to myself, maybe. No, I've never sang in any choir or any No, I don't.
Okay, well, we won't make you do it now then.
I'm glad for that.
Okay.
And, actually, they did give him a hard time at first. When he came on board, he addressed one of the other sailors with "du." And you may be, you may know that in German, there's the distinction between "you" and "sie." You address the your friends, your colleagues with "du" usually, and people you're not that familiar with or superiors, you address with the more polite "sie." And that other sailor actually started hitting him, and only because a more senior sailor saw this and sort of protected Preen, did he not get beaten up. And actually, Preen said later to that sailor, I wouldn't have let him keep beating me. I would have fought back and I would have probably beat him. But then the older sailor said, you would have been the weaker in any case, because if you had managed to beat up that sailor, we all, the rest of the sailors, would have had to beat you up, because discipline demands that. So, yeah, these were rough times.
Yeah, it would have been insubordination if he'd,
yes,
if he'd done that. And he was too informal. And I think on the boats as well, discipline is physical discipline, or it always was. That probably isn't so much now. You know, they used to have a cat of nine tails. And again, because there's too much risk of, if you're at sea, if somebody does something stupid, that, you know, everyone else is then put at risk by them. So you'd have to use physical discipline in order to keep order. It's a very different to being on the land, a different situation altogether, I think. I think if you're on the boats at sea, you're allowed to keep guns on there, I believe. And there's different laws for piracy as well, for if somebody gets on the boat that isn't part of the crew. There's all different laws that they have at sea to that they actually have on the land. And there's like a sort of brotherhood of people that do go to sea, these sailors, fishermen, yachtsmen, and, you know, more so the sailors and the fishermen, I would have thought. Was this merchant vessel that he was on, or was this a naval vessel that he was training on?
That was a merchant vessel. They were carrying cargo.
Yeah, merchant navy. They still would have had strict discipline on there, more discipline than they would have had at land, I would have thought. But
yes, I did get a sense of that when reading his memoirs.
I'm sort of dragging the conversation off its theme a bit here. Would you like to continue, Schmidt?
Yes. The voyage home was not uneventful at all. On the contrary, they had to deal with a fire on board, which almost turned disastrous, as stored petrol was in danger of igniting. But this was resolved, fortunately. Preen and a friend were now acting as cooks, because the cook had defected, as I said earlier. Their food was so much better that the crew was used to, was so much better than what the crew was used to, so that they soon endeared themselves to everybody. Except for that one time when, but I should really cut this short. I tremendously enjoyed reading about his career as a merchant sailor, but I shouldn't go too far off topic here. So when they were almost back home, they got into a very severe storm and had to seek shelter in Dublin. The Hamburg was quite damaged in the events. In fact, so much so that it was later declared a total wreck. Preen and his fellow sailors did enjoy their time in Dublin, though, as the Irish were especially friendly to the Germans. Another ship was sent to fetch them and bring them back to Germany. This was only the first of many merchant marine or navy voyages, and Preen slowly worked his way up, serving as a fourth officer on a steamer, for example, and then later even managed to become a licensed captain. These were still the days of the Weimar Republic, though, and he could not find any work as a captain. He tried to find any kind of work, but was unsuccessful. He didn't seek unemployment money until all his savings were spent, and he couldn't bear the thought anymore of friends or his mother assisting him. He reluctantly went to the assistance board. I will quote what he experienced there. "In the grey and dirty waiting room, some people were sitting. They looked exhausted, completely wrecked, as if destitute had eaten them from the inside and had left nothing but an outer shell, end quote. And later, when he was in the queue to collect the money, he observed the dehumanizing effect the situation had on the people. The stamping of documents was the metronome, quote. It moved rhythmically, this procession of misery, always intact according to the drumbeat of destitute. The view of all these jaded, hopeless faces, the rancid smell of poverty, the constant rum-bum, and he means the sound of the stamp, was crushing, end quote. He felt anger rising in himself, anger at those in power who didn't seem to care one bit about the plight of the working man. Or again, in his own words, quote, how could they sleep at night as long as there were people strong and healthy, willing to work, greedy for work, and now rotting like foul straw? Those few pennies that they threw at you were only staving off actual starvation. They gave them grudgingly because they feared our desperation. Oh, indeed, they were able to sleep, these gentlemen. They were able to sleep only too well on the soft cushion of their motto, live and let live. But reality had removed the glitter from their hollow phrases. We down here saw life as it was, and we also saw how they were. Live and let die, that was in truth their motto, end quote. A furious anger against this soft, mendacious indifference took hold of me. Actually, the quote wasn't over yet. It was in these days that I became a member of the National Socialist Movement, end quote. And by the way, the German Wikipedia article on Günther Prien says he joined the NSDAP in 1931, but this is clearly wrong. And the English one, on the other hand, is correct when it says 1932. Apparently, Prien joined the movement as party member number 1,128,487. He wanted to work, and since there was no paid work available, he volunteered for the Voluntary Reich Labor Service. Even there he was refused because they deemed him too old at 24 years of age. But then finally one application to go work camp was answered in a positive way. To give some more insight into his personality, I will quickly quote what happened when he arrived by train near where the work camp was. Quote, I was depressed. Each time before a sea voyage, I felt upbeat, but I wasn't looking forward to what was coming this time. Certainly, any kind of life was better than lazily sitting around. But I was a sailor with heart and soul after all, and a sailor on land feels betrayed, like a duck on dry soil. In the garden of a villa, he saw a girl sitting, blonde and entirely in white. I looked at her and felt bitter that more than a garden fence separated me from her, end quote. But he felt inspired, set down his baggage and went to buy roses. He entered the garden, went up to the girl, handed her the flowers and kissed her. The girl looked at him in astonishment, but she did not say anything. He gazed into her eyes for another moment and then turned to leave, not looking back. This event would later lead to his marriage, but in a somewhat unexpected way. And I will talk a bit more about this in the second part next week. During his time at the work camp, the depot master there committed suicide. They found a letter in which his girlfriend had written to him that she had been waiting for 4 years now and that he would never find paid work. By the time they could marry, she would be an old woman. And Prien's comments on that reads as follows. Yes, it was always the same. Destitute, misery, desperation, and the future like a merciless gray sky. You had to be tough to be able to bear it, end quote. As we know, times were about to change in Germany, but it came too late for that poor fellow. At the work camp, Prien quickly rose through the ranks of the hierarchy there and became deputy to the camp commander. When the camp commander was on leave and Prien was in charge, he learned that leadership is not always easy, and hard decisions have to be made at times. A ham had been stolen in a nearby village, and it seemed likely that one of his men did it. Or boys, rather. After some investigation, he found the thief. It was a thin and small boy from Dresden, a poor wretch who admitted to the theft immediately when confronted with the accusation. Tears were streaming down the boy's face, but he would not reply when asked why he had stolen the ham. It later turned out that his mother was very ill, and he had intended to sell the ham so he could send the money home to his mother. Even after learning this, Prien did not revise his decision to send the boy home. His reasoning was that discipline could not be kept if he were to make an exception for the boy. The reputation of the work service was also at stake if thievery was not punished, even though it was a very hard decision for him. For a last quote today, this is what Prien thought about the dilemma, and next week we will hear about his career in the German Navy, the military Navy. Quote, "For the first time I had perceived this antagonism in its full sharpness. Here the lot of an individual, there the well-being of the community. I had decided for the community, and I knew I would act in the same way each time, no matter how hard it would be." End quote.
So when he was working there with that work detail, was that after the National Socialists had taken power? Was that with the Weimar Republic still? And was he being paid for that work detail, or was that he just had to work and went out and did voluntary work?
Well, to the first question, it was the Weimar Republic, and this voluntary Reich labor service was actually, the NSDAP was already in parliament, and they had pushed for this, they pushed so hard with that much pressure that the government actually gave in, and so the voluntary labor service was actually created before the National Socialists took power. And he did not get paid. He would get free quarters and get free food, but he did not get any pay from that.
That's what I was just thinking. He must have still had a roof over his head and food given to him for that. At least he was contributing to the country. This is what they should be doing when you've got unemployment, is providing the things that people need and setting up projects that need doing. Roads need repairing, telephone line cables need laying so that everyone has the internet. And this is something they could be doing today in Britain. They could be providing, the work there to get everybody connected to the internet and providing food and lodging and clothing and a bit of money on the side to the people that are doing it, instead of saying, well, we can't afford to do this, or we haven't got enough people to do this. They shouldn't be importing foreigners into the country when you've got unemployed British people. It's this is one of the good things about Donald Trump. One of the first things he said he was doing was a big engineering project, infrastructure project, which is going to provide jobs for people. Obviously, building the wall is going to provide jobs for people. And it gives you an idea of how poor they were as well in that period. If that young lad had to steal that ham, and if he was unable to find a job doing anything, and you're talking somebody with skills there as well, who's been in the merchant navy, I would also say that that was probably very character building for him as well, seeing the state that the people around him were in. And then when he was a naval officer, he would have been sort of upper class, but he'd also seen what it was like to be lower class. So I should imagine he was a very fair man to work under, as it were. Dennis, have you got any comments you'd like to make on that before we move into the Weimar discussion?
Yeah, well, I had to smile when he said he couldn't find a job, because at the time, under the Weimar Republic, they only had 36 ships due to the, Versailles Treaty. So there would have been a queue for jobs on them ships, I'm sure.
Yeah, they really took everything off them, didn't they? That was the military side of it, wasn't it? Was that the military? Is that right?
Oh, yeah, it was. They weren't allowed a navy. Well, maybe, I'm not so sure about that, because they weren't allowed a navy. They just had 36 ships in actually active. So it could well have been, I wouldn't have just thought it was military.
Well, I would have thought if they wanted, they wanted to take everything they could from Germany, didn't they? So there really wouldn't have been very much trade that, that Germany could do, sending ships abroad, selling stuff. You know, the other victorious powers would have wanted their cut of it. They would have been wanting to take it from Germany and then sell it on to make money for themselves. They wouldn't have allowed Germany to trade. I think that was the whole point of the First World War, was that Germany was getting too big at trade and too good at trading, and Britain wanted to be on the top, and America wanted to be on the top, and they couldn't possibly allow Germany to get a footing. I think that was why Hitler was saying, well, you know, we'll get land in Russia or stay in Europe, and we'll let you guys have all the colonies if you just let us have some land here in Europe for when our people increase in size. And they weren't allowed to have that either. They really wanted to keep Germany down, didn't they?
Well, took all the colonies off them, didn't they? So they're never going to throw an helping hand, I don't think.
I'm going to quickly recap as usual. We were talking about how Breen grew up in the Weimar Republic and how depressing those days were for Breen as well as for most other Germans. I explained how he came to be a sailor and how he loved the life of a sailor despite the hardships, how he became a licensed captain in the merchant navy and yet became unemployed, and how that led to his participation in the voluntary Reich Labor Service. And now, how he joined the Kriegsmarine and his experiences in the war. In 1933, while still with the labor service, he got news that the Kriegsmarine, the German Navy, was looking for merchant Navy officers to retrain as soldiers. There was no hesitating for Breen, as his longing for the sea had never really left him. After basic training, he served on a light cruiser, and in 1937, he attended the U-boat school in Kiel. In the first few weeks there, he learned all about the theory of submarine warfare, and then finally, theory was put into practice. He was posted on U-3 as a officer candidate. In spite of all the theory, he found the experience of climbing down the hatch into the belly of U-3 quite bewildering. Bright white light was mirrored in glass, nickel and brass. There was a tangle of electric wiring, air pressure tubes and hand wheels. The noise from the diesel engines was deafening and the space was very tight. They were introduced to the LE, or chief engineer, who instructed them in the handling of a U-boat. Soon after that, Breen experienced the first submerging of the boat. It was put at the bottom of the sea, 22 meters below the surface, and they had lunch there. He soon got used to the daily routine on submarines, but he always remembered his first experience very sharply. In 1937, he became 1WO, or First Watch Officer, on U-26 of the Type 1A, serving under Werner Hartmann. I don't think there is an exact equivalent of the 1WO in the English-speaking navies, but the function is basically that of a second-in-command to the commander, and he's responsible for the steering of the vessel. The name Werner Hartmann may have sounded familiar to regular listeners. It was the same Hartmann who was involved in the Laconia incident, which I talked about some weeks ago. Hartmann told him that for the moment he had no use for him and suggested to him that he take a week of leave, which he did. On his way back to Leipzig, he met an ensign who showed him a photograph of a New Year's ball. He saw the blonde girl he had kissed in the garden of a villa, which I recounted last week. He asked the ensign for the address of the girl and wrote a letter to her. Soon a reply came back. The girl thanked for the letter and wrote that she had been quite amused by it, but that she had never been in Plauen, where Breen had kissed that girl. Regardless, the girl, the one he had written the letter to, became his wife half a year later, and he never regretted the mix-up. After his short leave, Hartmann told him that they had been ordered to cruise to the Spanish coast. In a hurry, U-26 was made battle-ready. Provisions, fuel torpedoes and shells for the deck cannon were brought aboard and stored. This was the time of the Spanish Civil War, and encounters with the Soviet supply or warships could have turned hostile. And the very next day, they left port for Spain. When they were in the English Channel, drills were held, and Prien was reminded that serving aboard a submarine could be dangerous even when no enemies were near. The order was given to dive, and all stations had reported clear for dive. The order then was then given to flood the tanks, but then someone was yelling in the bow compartment, "The eel, the eel!" And the German U-boat crews informally called the torpedoes eels. Prien ran to the bow and saw that a torpedo was hanging out of its tube. Four men were holding it back, but if the boat would tilt even more to the aft, they would be crushed. Prien ran a few steps back and yelled to the LE what was happening. He immediately understood, and the diving plane was adjusted, averting the catastrophe. The responsible crewman was found. He admitted to having given the clear for dive too soon. Werner Hartmann gave him a stern dressing down, which in Prien's word made, quote-unquote, the curtains wobble. By breakfast time, however, things were already smooth again. It was not the only dangerous incident. They got into the worst storm Prien experienced on a U-boat, at least up to the time he wrote his memoirs. The waves were so high that they were rolling over the crewmen, which were on watch on the tower, and one man almost went overboard when his harness broke. Hartmann was able to grab him in the last second and save his life. Hartmann decided to continue their cruise underwater, and when they surfaced again, they saw the Spanish coast in the light of dawn. They could faintly hear the thunder of artillery coming from the coast when the wind was just right. When they were cruising near Bilbao, they spotted two warships, a cruiser and a destroyer, the Almirante Cervera and the Velasco, as it later turned out, two Spanish Navy ships. They were heading straight for U-26 and were training their guns on the submarine. Hartmann concluded that they must be taking them for a Soviet submarine. He decided to show them his broadside, stop the engines and have the Reich war flag raised, and to keep signaling them in Morse code, Alemán, Alemán, the Spanish word for German. They kept heading straight for them, however. "Quite a sticky region here," Prien said, and loosened his collar, which made Hartmann laugh. And then finally the Spanish ships started to veer round and their guns moved back to zero position. They saluted their German allies. In December 1938, he was promoted to Kapitänsleutnant and finally given his own command, U-47 of the Type 7B. He stepped in front of the assembled new crew. He greeted them with "Heil Besatzung." Besatzung means crew, and they replied with "Heil Herr Oberleutnant." He told them, quote, "In a few days we will put into service a new unit of the German Kriegsmarine. I expect every man to do his duty as I will do mine. If this will be the case, we will get along just fine," end quote. The crew were all volunteers to the U-boat Waffe. They were hoping to experience more than the daily routine on a battleship, according to Prien. During the first half of 1939, they were getting acquainted with U-47 and each other during several training exercises on the open sea. They were on another exercise patrol in the Atlantic when the news of a possible imminent war began to reach them. Prien remarked that the crew was getting a little sloppy and their attitude towards the drills and a lot of political discussions went on between the crew members. Quote, "But deep inside, we did not believe there would be war, at least not on a large scale. For the thought that the great peoples would again butcher each other was too absurd. But then it came after all," end quote. The special announcement came over the radio. War with England. Everybody on board fell silent. The officers were looking at Prien, who went to the maps and ordering a new bearing of 220 degrees, he pointed to a location on the map. Here is where I want to operate. From the stern of the boat, a sailor could be heard. Quote, "May God have mercy on those guilty of such a war," end quote. The very next day, they sighted a steamer. Preen gave the order to go to periscope depth, and when the steamer was close enough, U-47 surfaced and fired a warning shot from the deck gun in front of the steamer. The captain of the steamer was prompted to stop, which he did, but it turned out it was sailing under the flag of a neutral country and in fact was carrying cargo for Germany, so it was allowed to continue, with the warning not to use the radio, as this would be considered a hostile act. On the morning of the 5th of September, the British steamer Bosnia was sighted, which immediately radioed for assistance. The Bosnia was hit by several shots from the deck cannon, 8.8 centimeters, by the way, or 3.46 inches, the same caliber as used on a Tiger Panzer, for example. As the Bosnia came to a stop, a Norwegian ship approached and Preen asked if its captain to take aboard the British sailors, which in the meantime had boarded their lifeboats. And then from a distance of 600 meters, Preen ordered the launching of his first armed torpedo of the war. The Eel hit the Bosnia midship and it sank after only 1 minute. The next day it was the British steamer Rio Claro which fell prey to U-47, and the day after, the British steamer Gartavon. The crew of the Gartavon somehow managed to let their abandoned ship loose on a collision course with U-47. They probably fixated the rudder somehow. It was quite a close call for U-47, and it taught Preen a lesson. Even an unarmed steamer can be used as a weapon. He went after the lifeboats and asked the captain whether there were still crewmen on board the Gartavon. The British captain replied with, "No, sir." Preen then told him that since he had committed a hostile act, he would not radio for their help, but would send a neutral ship for them once he had met one. After that, they sunk the Gartavon with the deck artillery only. It took them several shots to sink the ship, which was still sailing in circles. U-47 returned home after having sunk 8,270 gross registered tons of enemy ships. Back in Germany, Preen was called for a meeting with Karl Dönitz, at that time FDU, Führer der U-Boote, or Commander of the Submarines. Dönitz asked him whether he thought it was possible for a single U-boat to enter the heavily guarded British naval base at Scapa Flow, located within the Orkney Islands, and attack British warships there. Preen was given all the available maps and data and a few days to come to his own conclusion whether it was possible at all. Dönitz made it very clear that Preen was free in his decision. It was not an order to attack. If he would come to the conclusion that it could not be done, then that was it. After he made the necessary calculations and had thought it all through, Preen reported back to the Lion, Dönitz's nickname among many sailors. Dönitz looked at him for a while and then asked, "Yes or no, Preen?" "Jawohl, Herr Commodore," was Preen's reply. And so on the 8th of October 1939, U-47 left for the Orkney Islands. Whenever they would sight the ship, they would submerge. But at night, they would run with both diesel engines at full power on the surface. None of the crew knew where they were going. When they reached the Orkney Islands on the evening of the 12th, the 1WO, the first watch officer, Endras, asked Preen, "Are we going to visit the Orkneys, Herr Kapitänsleutnant?" Preen was finally able to drop the secrecy and replied, "You better hold on to something, Endras. We are going into Scapa Flow." For a few seconds there was silence, and then Endras replied with a calm voice, "Das geht klar, Herr Kapitänleutnant, die Sache geht klar." "That's all right, Captain, this thing will turn out fine." Preen writes that Endras could not have come up with any better words at this very hour. After telling the rest of the crew, he gave the orders. They're going to let U-47 rest on the seafloor for the night. All crewmen that are not needed are ordered to sleep if they can or otherwise rest to conserve oxygen. Explosive charges are put in place in case the operation fails. U-47 must not fall into enemy hands. After a last meal, they will not get any more warm food until the operation is over. Smoking is strictly prohibited. Then at 1900 hours, Preen gives the order to go to periscope depth. Slowly, U-47 rises. Preen looks through the periscope. Everything is calm and it's dark. Then he gives the order to surface. After the tower hatch is opened, fresh air streams into the boat. All seems quiet and no enemy ships can be seen. But even though it is dark, it feels like it is not as dark as it should be. And then Preen realizes that it is the Northern Light. They had chosen a new moon for the operation, and now the clouds in the north were lit up by the Northern Light. Nobody had thought of that. Yet, Preen ordered slow speed ahead. Delaying the operation is out of the question for him. After a while, a shadow is spotted, which could be an enemy vessel, so the alarm to dive is given. At periscope depth, they slowly proceed, and the mountains flanking their passage into Scapa Flow on either side loom higher and higher. They have to pass the wreck of a ship that was scuttled to block the passage they are attempting. They dive under the bow of the wreck, and the boat's antenna gets torn off, but they make it. They are inside the bay of Scapa Flow. After surfacing, they slowly proceed, and whenever they see one of the vessels guarding and patrolling the bay, they change course to avoid them. Then finally, Warensdorf, second watch officer, reports a very large shadow ahead. Preen gives the orders to get in closer. It seems to be a battleship. After a while, they see another one behind it, another ship. The one in front is identified as the Royal Oak. Preen orders all four bow torpedo tubes to be made ready for a surface launch, and only a few moments later they are reported clear. Preen orders a fan shot on the Royal Oak and a single shot on the other target. All torpedoes are ready to fire and Preen gives the order. Three torpedoes are running towards the targets. The fourth is a failure and doesn't launch. U-47 turns around to also launch the torpedoes in the aft tubes. But only one torpedo hits its target, the Royal Oak, and explodes. A giant fountain of water rises in the air where the torpedo hit. Preen is now faced with the decision whether to reroute the tubes and attack again, or head as quickly to the passage out of the bay as possible. He decides to attack one more time. This time, three more torpedoes find their target. Bright lights from the explosions can be seen, and several destroyers are now out to hunt for Preen. With full speed ahead, U-47 heads to the passage out of Scapa Flow, but the current is working against them, and progress is very slow. Against all odds, they make it. Behind them, they hear depth charges exploding. The British vessels must have thought their target was still inside the bay. 2 days later, the British Admiralty made the loss of the Royal Oak public. The other ship which was hit was the aircraft transport ship Pegasus. And they also reported that the enemy submarine is most likely destroyed. After they are back in Germany, Captain Preen and the crew are celebrated as heroes. Hitler orders them to be flown to Berlin, where he decorates Günther Preen with the Knight's Cross, and also decorates several other members of the crew with Iron Crosses. And Günther Preen was actually the first submarine captain to earn the Knight's Cross. Many combat patrols still followed after that, and in total, U-47 sank 30 Allied ships, totaling about 200,000 gross registered tons. In 1940, he was awarded the oak leaves to the Knight's Cross. Most of these successes were achieved against convoys of transport ships guarded by anti-submarine destroyers. The British kept getting better and better at detecting submarines and destroying them with depth charges. Life had gotten very hard for the German U-boat crews. On the 7th of March 1941, U-47 went missing. It was never established what precisely happened to them, but it may have been sunk by the British destroyer HMS Wolverine. It was quite a shock for Germany when Prien was reported missing. And for my last quote today and ending my report on Günther Prien, Dönitz wrote in the Order of the Day on the 23rd of May 1941, "Captain Prien, the hero of Scapa Flow and his brave crew, will live on in the hearts of all Germans."
What an amazing tale there. He does get spoken about still today. Didn't they make films about it? I mean, that daring raid into Scapa Flow, that was a huge symbolic victory. I mean, Orkney Islands is part of Britain. It's just at the top there on the north of Britain. That's right in the middle of the enemy territory, taking out, you know, the naval base. And it's an incredible symbolic victory there. And I didn't know that the Northern Lights could be seen there. I thought you had to be a lot further north than that. I didn't realise that they could be seen in the Orkney Islands. And I never really thought that storms would be a problem. If you're in a submarine, you just think, well, they can just submerge, surely. But I should imagine that they're actually limited with the amount of time they could spend submerged. Obviously, if they're traveling on the surface at night using the diesel engines, maybe it uses up more fuel if they're submerged. I guess it would do for the oxygen that's got to be produced. And living in those cramped quarters as well, you think of that small space that those men are living in together, you know, that they'd have to be a very strong character because small things would tend to wind people up a lot if you're in a small enclosed space with the same people. So you'd have to have a lot of self-control to not allow things to get to you. They must have been very, very brave men and deservedly won those awards. Dennis, have you got anything any comments you'd like to add to that?
Well, first of all, the thought of being in a submarine certainly doesn't appeal to me. I mean, to be caught being hit by the enemy in a submarine is, you know, 99%, it's going to be a problem. And plus the fact, the part when they said that the sailors were stunned when they heard about the war being declared, and that just goes to show that Hitler wasn't looking to rule the world, as many of these people who say that, you know, that it was financed by Wall Street and they were financing the war effort. All this went on before war was declared, and war wasn't even heard about till the final days of the Polish escapade. So yeah, I mean, if you're going to put me in a submarine, probably the last place I'd want to be.
Yeah, it'd be very easy to go stir crazy, wouldn't it? And I think that
sure.
What you were just bringing up there, I mean, that shows you that the German people were not interested in war. Even the people that were part of the Navy didn't want to have a war. Nobody wanted to have a war in Britain either, especially not people that were in the armed forces. And when they locked up the people that did protest against the war, I think one of the quotes was that there was more medals on the prison floor than had ever been seen at a Remembrance Day march, or words to that effect, meaning that all the protesters that were protesting against the war were all high up in the army. They were all people that knew what they were talking about and desperately wanted to avoid another war. Yeah, that was fascinating, Schmidt. Have you got anything else that you'd like to add to that?
Well, there were some subjects that you mentioned. the Northern Lights, they did not see the Northern Light directly. It was more that the clouds were illuminated by the Northern Light far in the north. And that was enough to make it, more bright than it should have been that night. And a film was indeed made in post-war Germany about Günter Prien, but they ridiculously turned him into an anti-national socialist. And I've read only bad things about it, so I'm not even going to attempt to watch it. They did make a movie, by the way, also about Hans-Joachim Maxey, and that one is kind of watchable. They also distorted his story somewhat, but it's somewhat watchable. Curiously, after that, both those movies were made in the 50s. And after that, none of these German war heroes was ever portrayed anymore in a German film, as far as I know.
Well, they must have really captured the public's imagination. You know, they must have seen them as great heroes. That's why they wanted to make the film about them. But then if they were going to make the film about the hero, the public hero, then they had to smear him in some way or make him anti-national socialist. And that shows you just how big these people were, the fact that they did actually make a film about him. Even though they made him anti-national socialist, he was still a big enough character for them to warrant that. And I would say at least one good thing about those two movies, Schmidt, you should be able to find some footage from them to go with the documentary when you do them, I would have thought.
Yeah, I could scour them for footage, but I'm not sure they would fit because, the dogfights are not really that well made back in the 1950s.
Right.
I mean, maybe some footage of the desert. Maybe I could use that for the Hans-Joachim Maxey movie. Yeah.
Anyway, thanks very much for that. These presentations are great. I'm sure you'll be able to find another one to find for us before too long now.